Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Lori Frankel, author of This Is How It Always Is, the story of five-year-old Claude, a lover of peanut butter sandwiches, dresses, and princesses. Claude is a boy who feels like a girl, and his family only wants him to be himself. The question is, how will the world respond? Monday, October 30th at 7 p.m. at The Ivy. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 315, for Thursday, the 26th day of October 2017. On today's show, Van Jones, the CNN commentator, who thinks it's time, almost a year after the election of Donald J. Trump, for Republicans and Democrats to start ignoring the president's daily antics and tweets and find common ground to solve some of the nation's problems. On election night, 2016, this is how Van Jones reacted to the news that Trump had scored enough electoral votes to defeat Democrat Hillary Clinton.
Well, look, first of all, you know, congratulations. Both of you guys were...
We're not there yet.
Well, right. You're further than anybody said you would be. And I have enough class, and I was raised well enough to say when you outdo...
Yes, sir. Thank you.
When you outdo expectations, you know, good for you. But there's another side to this. People have talked about a miracle. I'm hearing about a nightmare. It's hard to be a parent tonight for a lot of us. You tell your kids, don't be a bully. You tell your kids, don't be a bigot. You tell your kids, do your homework and be prepared. And then you have this outcome, and you have people putting children to bed tonight, and they're afraid of breakfast. They're afraid of, how do I explain this to my children? I have Muslim friends who are texting me tonight saying, should I leave the country? I have families of immigrants that are terrified tonight. This was many things. This was a rebellion against the elites. True, it was a complete reinvention of politics and polls, it's true. But it was also something else. I mean, we've talked about everything but race tonight. We've talked about income, we've talked about class, we've talked about region. We haven't talked about race. This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president, in part. And that's the part where the pain comes. And Donald Trump has a responsibility tonight to come out and reassure people that he is going to be the president of all the people who he insulted and offended and brushed aside. Yeah, when you say, you know, you want to take your country back, you got a lot of people who feel that we're not represented well either. But we don't want to feel that someone has been elected by throwing away some of us to appeal more deeply to others. So this is a deeply painful moment tonight. I know it's not just about race. There's more going on than that. But race is here too. We got to talk about it.
Those involved in publishing and marketing Van Jones's new book were tempted to call it White Lash. But instead, the book is called Beyond the Messy Truth, a reference to Van Jones's recurring primetime special, The Messy Truth. The subtitle of the book is key, How We Came Apart and How We Come Together. And in it, Van Jones offers a challenge to everyone opposed to Trump, including a growing number of Republicans, to acknowledge that the president is a divisive distraction from the nation's most important business, and to work toward common ground. There are big problems facing the country, and it's hard to find agreement on some of those. But as the CNN commentator outlines in his new book, there are places where compromise and solutions are possible. So I like the chapter, The Beautiful Work,
yes,
where you lay out four areas of common ground where you think people can work together to solve some problems. Because one problem, the criminal justice system, incarceration, mass incarceration, it's right up my alley. It's something I've been writing about for years. And it's where I found common ground.
Right.
Yeah. It's where I found Republicans saying, yeah, it doesn't make any sense to not prepare people to re-enter society once they're in prison. That's one thing, because then you just keep repeating the cycle, right? And I found that a lot of conservatives agree with me that things need to be fixed in that system.
Well, yeah, I think one of the things that has happened to us is that, you know, there are some things we're just going to have to fight about and we're just not going to agree about. And it's just we're going to have to vote against each other until one side or the other, you know, wins or loses. You know, I'm never going to back off on, you know, defending Muslims or sticking up for LGBTQ folks or immigrants or people who are in harm's way for some of Trump's policies. But you can't only fight and still have a country. I mean, you've got to find some areas where there's, you know, beyond the battleground, there's some common ground. And what I try to show in the book is, you know, that there are real serious issues where we already agree. Criminal justice is one. I talk about working with Newt Gingrich on that issue with some success. Another is this whole opioid and other addictions that are killing people by the, you know, thousands in our
country. It's a crisis.
It's a crisis. I mean, one of my close friends, Prince, the late rock star, died of an opioid overdose. And yet the coal miners I've been working with are also dying of that. So, and I've got in the book real common sense solutions at the level of policy from drug courts to everything else that could fix this thing starting tomorrow, especially with medically assisted treatment. So people don't detox and then die, but they get a little bit of medical support to stay off drugs until they can fully recover. All these kinds of things are there, and yet even when there are clear areas where we could do a much better job, we're not doing it because we're disagreeing so destructively on those places where there's disagreement that we aren't even speaking to each other in the places where there is agreement.
Or you present a idea, a proposal, and the other side, because it's the other side, says you're wrong.
Well, yeah.
I'm right, you're wrong, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I talk about that in the book as well. The default setting now for political discussion on both sides, on all sides, is simply, I'm right and you're wrong. Or worse, we're right and they're wrong. We're talking about each other, not even talking to each other anymore. And that is, you know what, sometimes that's okay. You know, there are times where you're in that fight. But geez, man, can we just fight from like 9 to noon, you know?
Yeah.
And then from like noon to 3, have a different conversation where the real goal is, I want to understand you and I want to be understood. Because it's the lack of understanding is where the inflammation comes from. Listen, it's a democracy. We're supposed to disagree. That's the whole point of a democracy. You get to disagree. Dictatorship, you can't disagree. Democracy, you get to disagree. It's called freedom. It's great. But the thing is, you want to disagree constructively so that you wind up with a thesis and then an antithesis and then a synthesis, where you might actually have a better idea at the end of the debate. And even if you disagree at the end, you have to vote against each other, you at least understand each other to be a part of the same community as opposed to mortal enemies, which is where we're headed.
Let me take two high-profile issues that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years where we can't seem to get an agreement on. Immigration is one, and the other is health insurance. So I just want to examine those with you. On immigration, the left looks at that and says, why are we being so hard on immigrants? Immigrants reanimate the American dream. You know, we need immigrants actually to keep up productivity in the workforce. They came into the country illegally, undocumented. Okay, let's accept that. We can't deport 11 million people. Why don't we put them on the path to citizenship? The other side says, no, that's a reward for breaking the law. We can't do that. And you can't get past that.
Right.
What part of illegal don't you understand, Dan, is what I hear when I present these ideas. That seems to end the conversation there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of those issues where if you start with immigration, if you start with abortion, if you start with health care, you're starting with the hardest issue with the least momentum. Even people who have come forward with very reasonable ideas, you know, the John McCain's of the world, the Marco Rubio's of the world have then been pilloried by their own party for even trying. And so that's one of those tough issues. And on those issues, you know, we're just going to have to fight. I mean, we're just going to have to, you know, vote against each other and not agree. I'm not going to ever back off on it. First of all, I just don't understand why we should stop cheating. See, America gets to win because we get to cheat. Have you ever seen the Olympics? The Olympics, the Chinese team, they're all Chinese. The Kenyan team, they're all from Kenya. The American team, we look like every color in the Skittles bag. We get to cheat. We get to get anybody we want to in the world here in our country. And we have the genius and the brilliance of every kind of human ever born. Because of immigration, we get to cheat. That's why.
I never heard it put that way. But, yeah,
but I, yeah. Listen, yeah. There's only 300 million Americans. There's 7 billion people in the world. If we got to fight everybody, I want to get the best of everybody else to come here. That way we can keep winning. People say, oh, Americans are great. No, Americans are not great. Remember your high school class? These people were not great. These people were mostly sorry. But we get to cheat and get the best people from every place else. I don't want to give up that advantage, and I don't understand why other people are so willing to.
Or my college basketball team had Manute Bol.
We'll see.
Who was a Dinka tribesman, 7 foot six, right?
Yeah, so look.
Okay, so I brought up immigration, Van, because I know it is tough.
Yeah.
I think people look at these high-profile issues like, you know, Obamacare, health insurance, and say, we're never going to bridge this divide because you keep saying no and we keep saying yes. I don't know how to get across. Maybe that's why you go to the beautiful work in your book, right?
Exactly. In other words,
you wanted to present four places where we could find some common ground.
Exactly, because I mean, here's the thing. We're not going to agree on a bunch of stuff, and that's okay. And I'm not worried about it in the long term because I think even though the pendulum swings around, it generally moves, I think, in a more progressive, more inclusive direction. We now call people unenlightened because they're not with the transgender cause. Don't forget that 5 years ago, President Barack Obama himself was a little bit hesitant to even say that he was for marriage equality among, you know, lesbians and gays.
That changed real fast.
So listen, there are areas where we're winning in the culture and winning in the law, and there's areas where we're not right now. I trust that we'll continue the overall progress. But here's what I worry about. Democracies can fail. Democracies can fail. They usually fail. And we sometimes underestimate the heroism of our own cause. To have 300 million people, every color, every faith, every kind of human being ever born in one country, and we mostly get along, but we're trying to run it as a democracy and a democracy that respects everybody's human rights and the earth. This is tough. This is the toughest challenge taken on ever. You have 10,000 years of human history where people were chopping each other into small bits because you were from one tribe, I was from another. You can't walk down the streets of a major American city without seeing every tribe in the world, and we're all here. So this is a tough thing, and the problem with the liberals and the progressives is that we have convinced ourselves that the hardest argument ever made, that your tribe is everyone, your tribe is humanity, that you're supposed to respect every human being, even people who don't look like you, that's the hardest argument ever made, is just obvious. It's just obvious. And anyone who doesn't get it is an idiot. Well, that sets us up to underestimate the Herculean daily effort of trying to make our case and make our and trying to advance this cause. And I think it caught up to us in 2016. Everybody acts like, you know, Donald Trump is this, you know, monster who came out of nowhere and prove that the country is racist and terrible. That is not true. Here's what happened. We didn't work that hard in 2016. The reality is, 2008, people worked very hard. They knew they had to advance this argument, and they fought for it in every cafeteria and barbershop and nail salon and bowling alley and sports bar. People went to swing states. People raised money. 2012, the same thing. 2016, we said, this guy is an idiot. He's going to lose. And so when you don't fight for inclusion and when you don't fight for these values, frankly, in both parties, when both parties take their foot off the gas in terms of going for their highest ideals, then demagogues can come in. So what this book is about, you know, Beyond the Messy Truth, it says how we came apart and how we come together. The how we came apart, there's got to be some tough love now for both parties. You don't wind up with a Donald Trump in office with two healthy parties, or frankly with one healthy party, and you got to start with that, and then you got to move quickly to finding some areas where there's some fellow feeling that we can continue to cultivate even as we battle it out on other issues, so that you still have a country at the end. And that's my concern.
If we don't
change directions, we're going to end up where we're headed, and where we're headed is not good.
Well, how do we change this direction then? Trump is so divisive.
Yes.
I guess we have to look, like in Congress, a Republican and a Democratic Senate leader said they would come up with a plan to continue to fund subsidies to insurance companies for low-income people to lower their deductibles under Obamacare. after Trump had just, you know, thrown a hand grenade into the room as the enrollment period for insurance begins. So maybe the grown-ups will take over. Is that what
I think that's what's required. And what I will say is that Donald Trump fancies himself a disruptor. You know, that's now the fancy term out of Silicon Valley, you know, the disruptors. Well, but he doesn't understand what the term means. You know, Uber didn't go get a bunch of baseball bats and smash up all the taxis. They had a better idea, and that's why they are now winning. Trump doesn't have better ideas. Trump just smashes everything.
Right.
And basically, his only idea is when he gets up in the morning, what did Obama do? Undo it. And so because of that, then liberals make a certain set of mistakes. For the past 2 years now, we've been saying Trump is crazy. And there's plenty of evidence that he may well be. But there is another definition of crazy, which is to do the same thing over and over and expect a different result. We've been doing exactly the same thing since he came down that escalator 2 years ago, saying that he is outrageous and bigoted and sexist and incompetent and all these things over and over. Most liberals that I know wake up in the morning, they grab their phone, they look at it, there's another tweet, and they go crazy and they spend their whole day upset. This is his strategy. He's ADD and now we're ADD. He is petty and all over the place, and now we're petty and all over the place. What I suggest in the book is that we get back to the hard work in both parties of recentering on real values that we believe in. If you're conservative, great. Then be a conservative and stick up for the country against Russia. Be a conservative and stick up for limited government. What the hell is the federal government poking its nose into the NFL and mainstream media? Be a conservative. Be a better conservative. I'll be a better progressive, and we'll get something done.
The term white lash, I believe, is yours.
Yes.
It's the first time I heard it was on election night 2016 from Van Jones. And you examine it in your book. You say not everyone who supported Donald Trump was a racist.
Yes.
You can't go about the world thinking that. We can't go forward if you think that.
Right.
And you don't accept it. So you wanted to examine why some people voted for Donald Trump, some who had voted for Barack Obama.
Yes, some had voted for him twice.
Right. So I read that chapter, and I remain skeptical about people's motivations there, that they may have some reason for voting for Donald Trump. They thought he would put a pro-life justice on the Supreme Court.
Which he did.
So they accepted all the other garbage that comes with Donald Trump, right? I just don't think, I don't think that's acceptable. I don't think there's any one issue that's worth a vote for a man who is so unfit to be president of the United States. So,
well, I mean, that's what liberals have been saying for 2 years, that he's unfit, he's unacceptable, and that's
No. I'm saying that I don't accept that people voted for him because they had some other issue that they cared about. I just have a hard time with it. I can accept it. You argue it well in the book, but I have a hard time with that because there's just so much baggage there.
Listen, if you talk to conservatives, they will be just as outraged about Hillary Clinton. And they will say, I cannot understand how anybody could ever vote for someone.
There's no comparison.
Well, and that's what you
say. In terms of flaws.
That's what you say. And so, and that's the problem. Is that
Honestly, Van? I just want to challenge you on this.
What?
I mean, do you see that this false equivalence that her sins are as bad as Trump's?
I don't agree with that. Of course not. I voted for Hillary Clinton. I vote for her 20 times a day. You would have to chop off limbs from my body to have me vote for Donald Trump or anybody like Donald Trump. I mean, I'm on the left side of Pluto, but that's not my point. My point is that there is a narrative that we have that we believe, that we reinforce every day by our, you know, who we read and watch and listen to. And there's also another narrative that 60 million Americans, not 20 weirdos, 60 million Americans found persuasive. And so I think it's at our peril that we then just say, well, all these people must be crazy. Well, if you're saying that 60 million Americans are crazy or racist, you should probably get a boat and get out of here, because that's a lot of crazy racists. I don't think that's what we're looking down the barrel of. It's more complicated. So I say the truth is messy. In fact,
I'm not saying they're crazy or they're racist. I'm just saying
they have bad judgment. Yeah, they have bad judgment. I agree with you.
Yeah, I'd say they have bad judgment, and that they were so focused on some particular issue that you're willing to look past so many issues with Trump.
And, you know, a lot of people voted for Hillary Clinton that didn't agree with her on everything and you know, found fault with her. But at the end of the day, they said, I'm a Democrat, I'm a progressive, I can't support. So listen, we had two very, very unpopular candidates. And, you know, we had a lot of interference. It was a weird election. But here's what I don't want us to do. I am desperate that liberals not continue to push more people toward Trump. In other words, I don't think he deserves 60 million votes. Or 6 million, or 6. I don't even think that Trump should have voted for him, okay? So I want to create a situation where he has to fight for every one of those people every day. I want to reach out. I want to find common ground. I want to, even where we disagree, I don't want to disrespect or disregard, because that just helps him. I don't think we understand how bad we sound in our pain, in our trauma, in being re-triggered and re-traumatized by this person every day. The people who don't see it the same way hear us to be saying, all of his supporters, if you voted for him, if you voted for a bigot, you are a bigot. If you voted for a sexist, you are a sexist. If you voted for someone that the Klan supported, you may as well be in the Klan. Hey, that's some heavy stuff to drop on somebody and then say, now come vote for me. Those two sentences don't follow rationally. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want us to fuel what we're fighting. I don't want us to feed what we're fighting. He needs us to be like him. He needs us to be angry and small and lacking in nuance or empathy. And presidents have a very interesting spiritual, emotional effect on a country. When JFK was president, everybody wanted to be in the Peace Corps because that was his thing. And then Reagan got in there. Everybody wanted to go to Wall Street, make a bunch of money because that was Reagan's thing. And then Obama got in there. And even the Republicans stopped fighting so hard against marriage equality because that was his thing. Now Trump's in there and everybody's acting like a jackass because he is such a jackass that it's hard for people to remember.
Now, you feel the response needs to be that.
Exactly. Right? And so my concern is he's pulling us down to his level, and that, in fact, he can continue to do pretty well at his level. So it's counterintuitive, but, you know, Dr. King and Nelson Mandela and Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Jo Baker and all the people from the civil rights traditions that, you know, I come out of faced much meaner people. With much more direct power to hurt them. And they responded with big-heartedness and with a certain kind of wisdom and grace about the situation, which ultimately delivered America into a more democratic space. I think that's the right way to go. I don't think it's easy. And any one individual, if you go to work every day and you're just overwhelmed and you're a woman and you're being re-triggered by this stuff, look, I'm not here telling you to go be some martyr. And I'm definitely not suggesting any of us be in an abusive relationship with any individual or with the president. But what I am saying is this. We might be stronger than we think. We may have some resources and some reserves that we haven't tapped yet that might let us meet this moment in a bigger way than what we've been doing for the past 2 years. And it's been 2 years. And so this book is really, if anything else, it's a guidebook, it's a prayer offering that we might actually meet this moment in a bigger way and get through it quicker than what we've been doing.
It's very challenging, Van.
Yeah.
The last two places of common ground, we didn't mention, if folks might be curious about, they can go buy the book and read it, but it has to do with jobs.
Yes.
And the high tech and clean tech.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that everybody knows that the robots are coming. You know, the White Walkers in this, you know, we got the Mad King that we're dealing with for all the Game of Thrones fans, but the White Walkers are coming, the zombies are coming, and what they are, it's artificial intelligence, it's drones, it's robots, and it's coming fast. I mean, you're talking about driverless vehicles, perhaps wiping out the entire trucking industry within 10 years. You're talking about artificial intelligence and voice recognition stuff that would essentially wipe out all of the call centers in India in 5 years. I mean, you're talking about massive disruption, massive dislocation. We're not even talking about that. And so what I point out in the book is that we've got to start, I mean, I don't care if you're for vouchers, I don't care if you're for public schools, I don't care if you're for charter schools, forget education reform. We've got to do curriculum reform quickly to get people ready for all these jobs that are leaving and the new jobs that are coming. And again, this idea of,
So you're ignoring Trump.
Yes.
Who's saying coal is coming back.
Yeah.
Coal mining is coming back.
But he's just lying.
Yeah. I know. You have to ignore the president here.
You have to listen. Title of this book probably should have been Ignore the
Trump.
President. Ignore Trump.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
F Trump, forget Trump.
Well,
you know,
in a way it is, isn't
yeah,
it?
Because
yeah.
otherwise you're going to go crazy. How many times can you just, spend a half a day upset over something this guy did? And at the end of the day, you have no more power. Your coalition is no bigger. His coalition is no smaller. He's got us in this reaction pattern, and we don't even see it. And it's been 2 years. So that's what I want us to move away from. So, for instance, you start talking, though, about what you can do. Look, a third of this book is our resources, organizations that you can join, books you can read.
I notice that. It's in the appendix is extensive.
Yeah. Because what I really wanted to give people was a toolbox. Yeah. To be like, okay, if I want to understand Republicans, what do I need to read? If I want to get deeper involved with progressive causes, what can I join? I wanted to give people all of the ideas and insights and observations that I have access to so that they can just get through their day better. People say, oh, Van, you're on TV with these crazy people and you seem so calm and you seem so respectful.
I've noticed, yeah.
Yeah, and I said, well, first of all, I've already read all their stuff. I know what they're going to say. You're shocked, because, you're in your own kind of bubble. But I deliberately on my Instagram account, it's not in the book, was going to maybe shock you. I searched for the term white nationalist, and I followed about 100 of them. And then I searched for pro-Trump, right wing, a bunch of terms. Now my social media feed is a horror show, but
I can imagine.
But I also followed a bunch of progressives and yoga people and whatever else. So there's a mix. But I now have a better understanding. I'm not as surprised by where people are coming from because in real time, every time there's an incident, I now have a balanced feed and I can see the overlap. I can see where we miss each other. I can see where they sometimes actually call us out on our hypocrisy, which I've got a blind spot to. They say, well, how can you be for the Muslims so much and also be a feminist? And those things don't go together. So these are tough challenges I hadn't thought about. And so part of what I wanted to do was, as somebody I've been a grassroots outsider fighting against police brutality and criminal justice for 15 years. Then I became a White House insider working with President Obama. I was a target of the media when the right wing went after me when I worked for President Obama for my left wing radical past. Now I'm a part of the mainstream media. I grew up in red state America on the edge of a small town, but I went to an Ivy League law school and taught at Princeton. I've been in and out and around. I'm African American, but my family is my family and friends, every race you can think of. So I've been in and out and around of all these different contradictions and all these different fights. And I wanted to put in a book a way to think about this that challenges liberals to be better progressives, challenges conservatives to be better conservatives, but gives everybody at least some stuff we can start working on collectively. Because I think the food fight is becoming destructive in and of itself, no matter who's winning or who's not, because it's pulling the country apart.
Just curious, what kind of feedback are you getting on the book?
It's really remarkable because this was a risky book for me because, you want the book to sell. And you sit down with your advisors and you say, well, geez, what are we going to do with this book? Well, the first thing, call it White Lash. Just call it White Lash.
It was tempting, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Because then, you don't even have to have pages in the book. It's going to be a bestseller. Just that. And I thought about it. I said, I don't want to do that. I really think that given what I've been privileged to know and see, and I've really worked with everybody from Newt Gingrich to Prince, there's a way through this. And then, there may not be a market out there. We know that the anti-liberal market, Fox and all that, we know the anti-Trump market. You're
in the middle there.
Yeah, you're suggesting that there might be a market for nuance.
Right.
It might be a market for empathy. reason?
Yeah.
Hope, even?
How did you convince a publisher to,
well,
to go along with it?
You know, there's a lot of begging and pleading. Yeah. But but I said, listen, let's just bet on reason and empathy and hope and solutions and see. So we don't know yet how the book is doing. I'm out here doing everything I can. I thought we would get out there and immediately be torn apart on Twitter by liberals saying I'm an appeaser and a false equivalence guy or whatever. So far, we haven't seen that. And people have been saying about the book, it's the first time I felt hopeful. And that, to me, is a good thing. The crazy thing about this book, of course, it's endorsed by Bernie Sanders and Cory Booker, so the establishment and the left wing of the party. And it's endorsed by Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee, who are very far, you know, far right Republicans.
And you got a blurb from Jeffrey Lord, too.
Yeah.
Your old friend.
Even my old buddy from CNN.
Yeah.
And it gives me a great deal of pride that both wings of the Democratic Party and very, very strong conservatives are all saying, look at this guy's book. There's some stuff in there that's useful, even though I don't agree with the guy on everything. And even just that is some medicine that we need, that you can say, look, read this person, listen to this woman, go to this person's speech, listen to this person's podcast. Even though we don't agree, we should still try to understand.
It might help you to get centered again to read this. I mean, I've found myself challenged by it.
Good.
Challenged to get over the anger about and resentment of Trump
mm-hmm.
and people who supported him. And, you know, I'm trying here, Van. We're trying.
Well, I mean, here's what I would say is that sometimes the bully wins. It's terrible. And I think most liberals and most progressives, we grew up maybe a little bit more sensitive, maybe a little bit more bookish, kind of like the bully magnets. And we just kind of had this faith that, well, you know what, these bullies, they may be picking on me now, or they may be picking on her now, or maybe there's a bully in my household, but I'm going to get away, and I'm going to go out there, I'm going to find a life, I'm going to make a life for myself, and I'm going to make the world more just. And then the bully, the bigot, wins the biggest prize in the world, and then it's just being a complete unimaginable asshole about it every day. It regresses us back to almost a childlike sense of helplessness and anger and frustration. But I do believe that we're stronger than we know. And I think that there are resources and reserves that we've not yet tapped into, that when we hit those reserves and start to stand back up again, I think it's going to be permanently transformative for the country. In other words, a breakdown can lead to a breakthrough. It's happened in your personal life. You look back at some of the worst things that have happened, a loss of a job or a relationship or a death, and it was terrible. I'll never get over this. I'll never get out of this. And yet something happened in that process that you now are a different human being and a better human being than you were. That's possible for countries too.
Right.
But it starts in people like us. And what I'm seeing is this prolonged grieving process, almost a year since the election, 2 years since he came down that escalator, has to come to an end. And people, they resist it. You always do when you're in grief. But you say, no, hold on a second. We're opening up the curtains. We're going to look this in the eye, and we're going to move forward, and we're going to be better and not bitter as a result of this thing. And that's what I'm calling for in the book.
Van, thanks very much.
Well, thank you.
Van Jones is a CNN political commentator and host of the recurring primetime special, The Messy Truth with Van Jones. His new book, published by Ballantine Books, is Beyond the Messy Truth, How We Came Apart, How We Come Together. Coming up on Friday, we have a cooking show. David Tanis, an accomplished chef and author of the City Kitchen column in the New York Times, has put together an extraordinarily good cookbook. David Tanis will be with us on Friday, and we'll hear him talk about some interesting ways to cook vegetables coming into the farmers markets this fall as we head into November and Thanksgiving. Also ahead, Heather Mazier, the progressive who ran for governor of Maryland in 2014. She's undertaking a new project, and we'll hear about that from her. And just for Halloween, the best of spooky music from the horror movies with Terrence Hannum, a connoisseur of that genre. That's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Jeffrey Kluger, whose new book, Apollo 8, presents the untold story of the historic moon voyage a national triumph that brought us the iconic Earthrise photo and closed out one of the darkest years in modern American history. Wednesday, November 1st at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.